folks. Thanks for tuning into Taste Radio, the number one podcast for the food and beverage industry. I'm editor and producer Ray Latif, and you're listening to episode 204, which features an interview with Vincent Kittiretrigarn, the co-founder and CEO of Dang Foods. Just a reminder, if you like what you hear on Taste Radio, please share the podcast with friends and colleagues. And of course, we'd love it if you could review us on the Apple Podcasts app or your listening platform of choice. Best known for its sweet and savory coconut chips, Dang Foods was launched in 2012 by brothers Vincent and Andrew Kittiretrigarn. Self-described as an Asian-American snack brand, Dang's portfolio also includes Thai rice chips and a fast-growing line of keto-certified snack bars that are made with Asian-inspired flavors. The brand is represented in over 13,000 retail locations nationwide, including at Kroger, Target, and Whole Foods, where its bars are the top-selling brand in its category, according to Dang. In the following interview, I spoke with Vincent about the company's origins and how the brand positioning has evolved over the years. He also discussed how Dang communicates the brand story across its product lines, why he keeps a tight grip on its innovation strategy, and the company's relationship with investment partner Sonoma Brands. Hey folks, it's Ray with Taste Radio. I'm on a call with Vincent Kittiretrigarn, the CEO and co-founder of Dang Foods. Vincent, thank you so much for being with me.
Thanks for having me, and great pronunciation of my last name.
Thank you very much. I got it on the first try this time. In prior occasions, I've butchered it just terribly, so thank you for putting up with me.
Yeah, practice makes perfect.
Indeed it does. A very interesting week for the natural foods community. This was the week that Natural Products Expo West 2020 was to be held. The show was postponed. How are you kind of navigating your way through this week?
Yeah, it was a really interesting last few days. You know, you saw a lot of retailers drop out on Friday. Over the weekend, a lot of brands started dropping out, and then a ton of people started putting pressure on the organizers to cancel the show, which they did. I think that was the right move. I think if the show had gone on, it would have been kind of a sad shell of what it normally is. So we'll see when it gets rescheduled. You know, we were excited to launch new packaging. We had a new booth. We have four new products to show, but we will still move on and as far as showing that to our customers.
Yeah, it seems like some of the younger brands, some of the early stage brands were most affected by the decision to postpone the event or the fact that they might not have been able to exhibit at the show even if it had gone on. But you guys have been around for about 8 years now, right?
Yeah, we launched in 2012. It's been 8 years.
Yeah. So talk a bit about the origins of the company. How did you guys get started and why is it called Dang?
Yeah. So, I mean, you understand now why we didn't call it Kittiretrigarn. It's hard to say. So how we started was I had this thesis that Thai food hadn't really been pushed forward in the U.S. And that came from going to visit Thailand and my family there every year as a kid. And so I'd go over there and see, oh my God, look at all this stuff besides Thai and besides mango sticky rice and all the sweet stuff that people in the U.S. love is like Thai American food. So, you know, it really came to, with this thesis that Thai food hadn't been moved forward in the U.S. and tried a bunch of things, including working at a restaurant and food trucks. And I ended up doing a pop-up restaurant in San Francisco. It was at a nightclub. And at the time, I had seven roommates. And they allowed you to actually cook in your house. You didn't have to get commercial kitchen space, which was really nice. So I started making Thai American dishes. And my first one was chicken satay. Did really well. And the second one was called Mian Kam, which is a Thai lettuce wrap from northern Thailand. My mom said that when she was in college, she used to run out of class and go to the Mian Kam stall and then go buy it every day. And so she gave me this recipe, wrote it up on an index card. It has lime, it has young ginger, it has toasted coconut. And she was like, you can't buy the toasted coconut in the store, so you have to go buy a regular coconut and then toast it yourself. So I did that. And in my seven-bedroom, seven-roommate house, all my roommates started coming out when I started toasting the coconut and saying, oh my God, what is this? It smells really good. And they started eating it right out of the pan. And that was when I was like, oh, this is interesting. You know, people like eating toasted coconut straight up. And so I called some family in Thailand. They got some samples, and we tasted them and talked to some manufacturers, had them send over samples. And we actually launched at Expo West back in 2012.
And you named it Dang after your mother?
Yes. So Dang is my mom's name. She's the one that gave us the recipe, and we kind of, you know, did it as an homage to her. It also means red, the color red in Thai, which is a lucky color and a lot of Asian heritage. And then it's also here. It's a euphemism for damn, right? So everybody here, like our tagline is Dang, that's good. And one thing that people say when they eat our products pretty often is, oh, dang, that's good. So it works really well.
Now, Dang has undergone a few iterations in terms of its positioning over the years. Its current one, which you recently unveiled, is that of an Asian American inspired brand.
Sure. So current positioning is Asian American snacks. Really, nobody else has the positioning. I would say that as a brand, what we do want to stand for is heritage. So we're taking flavors and ingredients from East and Southeast Asia, since that's where our family's from, and bringing them to the U.S. in healthy and familiar formats. And if you look at Asian food culture, it tends to be three things: plant-based, tends to be low sugar, and tends to be whole food-based, right? And if you look at the American diet, it tends to be higher meat consumption, higher sugar content, and then very processed. So we're really trying to say, hey, Asian food culture, there's a lot going on there. It's been 5,000 years of culture that's in our food and ancient wisdom. And so we want to bring more of that to the U.S. in a familiar format. So when we launched, we want to communicate, hey, this is a natural, healthy, tasty snack, right? We also didn't want to get pigeonholed into the Asian area of the store because it's less trafficked. So we always said from the beginning, hey, this is going to be a brand that very accessible, that any American can understand quickly what it is and how to eat it. And so, you know, we decided to make a little bit more like, you know, healthy, natural type of packaging at the beginning. So, you know, it took a bunch of soul searching. And I also think the timing is great given the success of movies like Crazy Rich Asians and Parasite. And I think there's a lot of pride going on in the Asian American community right now.
It's interesting. When you and I talked prior to this interview, you described the Asian American consumer as, quote, the perfect consumer when designing a brand. Why is that?
Yeah, so some statistics. Asian Americans, 20 million of us, that's 6% of the U.S. population, right? It's the highest income consumer. It's the highest education consumer, right? And so they have the highest levels of education. Most likely to be organic eaters, most likely to be vegetarians. And nobody's speaking to that consumer. You know, there's typically American brands and then there's typically Asian brands, right? But when you put the two together, you see a lot of success as far as restaurants go and speaking, you know, using food as that language, that lingua franca. But almost no consumer brands are targeting this group. It's a very tech-savvy group. You know, get a lot of information online. If you see, you know, social media use is extremely high in that group. So when you look at the consumer, right, and when we looked at our consumer, we were like, oh, we actually index the highest with Asian Americans of all heritage groups. So we were like, hey, you know, nobody's really speaking to this consumer right now. And this positioning is something that we can fully authentically own, being, you know, Asian Americans that were born here. So we were like, hey, you know, there's an opportunity here to take a position and say, hey, you know, first off, we're one of the community, we are Asian American, and then we can speak to you in a way that, you know, is very culturally specific in ways that other brands cannot.
Do you think your current positioning could have existed when you first launched?
I'd like to think that yes, it could have, but I don't know if we would have grown as quickly. So, you know, I think our intent was, you know, we launched with coconut chips, and at the time, coconut was doing great, right? So there was a huge growth of interest in coconut water and coconut oil. And that's how we spoke about our coconut chips. We were like, hey, you know, it's got all the health benefits of coconut oil, healthy, tasty snack. And, you know, the colors that we had in our original packaging are all very coconutty, right? So there's like light tans and browns and greens. And so, you know, I really liked our original packaging because it did kind of showcase that healthy, natural, tasty positioning. And it reached a lot of people. And, you know, it was not mistaken for an Asian or Asian American snack. And it helped us grow pretty quickly. And I think now, you know, I would like to think that media and culture is like caught up. And so, you know, I'd say that there's a lot more of like wearing who you are on your sleeve now than there was back in 2012.
What's been the most effective way of communicating your ingredients and your products to a consumer who is not familiar with either?
Yeah, that's a good question. So if you're not familiar with something like coconut or sticky rice, we want to minimize the amount of work it takes to get there. So first off, us being a snack company, there's no preparation needed. You don't need to heat anything, refrigerate anything. It's all shelf stable. You know, it's very easy to open a bag and pop it in your mouth. So that's number one, right? Number two is we have to do a lot of education as far as, you know, how you eat the product, when do you eat it? Like, what's the eating occasion? That's always a big question that we ask ourselves. You know, what do you substitute it for? So, you know, what are you not eating instead of eating coconut chips and rice chips? We are changing the name of our formerly sticky rice chip line to Thai rice chips because a lot of consumers are actually mistaken that sticky rice chips are going to be sticky, whereas sticky rice is, you know, something It's a staple in northern Thailand, Laos, Cambodia. And it's not actually sticky, especially when we treat it. You know, the way we treat it is we crisp it up and it's not sticky anymore. So we learn things like this, like Americans don't know that sticky rice isn't sticky necessarily. And so that's why we have to change the name in order to, you know, make it a little bit more accessible.
Let's talk a little bit about the evolution of your portfolio, because you started out with coconut chips, expanded into sticky rice chips, now Thai rice chips. You know, how do you think about introducing new products within the focus of being an Asian American brand or a maker of Asian American snacks?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, how we do innovation is it's good. It's a central question, I guess, for any company, any brand. So, you know, we start with a couple of things. We start with, you know, what do we have license to go into as a brand or a snack company? We only do shelf-stable snacks. So, you know, we're likely to stay within that category. That being said, you know, we do a lot of data crunching and we want to understand where there's big opportunities. So, you know, after we did sticky rice chips and coconut chips, we looked at the bar category and we're like, oh man, there's a huge glaring hole right now for, you know, high fat, low carb snacks in the bar set. And the reason we knew this is because we had a coconut chip. We have a coconut chip with no added sugar. It's unsweetened. And that was our loudest consumer champion right there. They were saying, oh my God, this, you know, I can't find anything that's low sugar and has healthy fats. And I want you guys to make more of this stuff. So that's how we ended up looking at the bar set. And after looking at it, analyzing and saying, hey, you know, we can go in there as long as we have, you know, our Asian American ingredients and flavors, then, you know, that's why we ended up going into the bar set. But I would say, first off, is looking at the brand guidelines and like what you can go into. And then secondly, you know, looking at categories, category size especially is really important of, you know, how big is the category, how big is the pie that you want to take a piece of. I think all that's super important when you're looking at, okay, where do I innovate strategically? What direction do you take your company in?
When you say category size is really important, are you talking about category size as in it's only worth it if the category is big enough?
I would say that category size, like there has to be a big enough pie for you to, you know, have it to be a significant part of your business. But then also the competitive dynamics are really important as well. So is there a major player? Do they have a big weakness, right? Now, what are all the niches? What are people going for that set for? So for nutrition bars, just thousands of nutrition bars meeting all kinds of needs, right? But is there something that's missing in that set right now? And that's why we launched our product. And it was actually, our Dang Bar is the number one selling bar at Whole Foods last year in terms of unit velocity. So, you know, we launched in January 2019. We saw initial numbers were great, right? We're selling like 30, 40 units a store. And we were very surprised when it stayed that high even throughout the year. So the bar set is $7 billion and still growing. We were like, oh, we could get a piece of this. And we wanted to extend out into different categories. And so that one was the one that stood out to us.
Now, we live in an era where consumers are sugar averse, or at least reducing their sugar consumption pretty significantly. How does that factor into your product development? How does that factor into your product strategy?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, one thing that we actually saw when we looked at the Asian American community in the U.S. was there's a really high level of diabetes. So Asian Americans are about twice as susceptible as the average American to develop diabetes, and about half as likely to have it be diagnosed. So they often go undiagnosed. And so we said, hey, if we're really going to speak to this community, you know, what can we do to actually improve the health over the long term? And part of that was creating sugar-free or low-sugar products. And so our Dang Bar, 2 to 3 grams of sugar, nothing added, no added sugar to it. You know, that was one way we wanted to do it. We're also working on lowering sugar levels across the rest of our line. So some of our coconut chips at this point do have added sugar, either coconut or cane sugar. And we're setting the goal to lower it by 50% by 2021. So that's kind of been in the hopper. And, you know, that's something that we can do and say, hey, you know, this is a community that's being afflicted by diabetes. You know, we want to be a part of the solution.
One of the interesting things you mentioned when we were talking prior to this call is that you said too many steps forward and the customer gets lost. So how many steps was too far for you? I mean, I guess when you're mapping this thing out, were there any steps that you said, no, we can't go this far because the consumer won't understand it?
Yeah, for the bar line, it's kind of, I'd say for the bar line, it's flavors. Like, you don't want to get way too esoteric with flavors. Most bar buyers want chocolate, want peanut butter, want birthday cake. They want like those indulgent things that they can't eat, right? Because they're on whatever keto, paleo diets, right? And so if you go way too esoteric, like if I launched a pandan flavor or a seaweed bar, that would just go over people's heads, right? They would just go back to what they're used to. So you can't go too wide, I would say. But it definitely depends on the category. So, you know, if you look at something like coconut chips and rice chips, it's already a leap in someone's mind to go and buy a coconut chip if they're not used to that. Then it would be two leaps if you went and said, okay, let's do a coconut chip with gochujang, like a sweet Korean sauce on it. A lot of people don't know what that is. And, you know, it's one of those more esoteric flavors that isn't mainstream yet. However, if you do a rice chip and you're like, hey, this is sriracha, it's not that far of a leap for someone to imagine what that tastes like, right? I know what rice tastes like. And I know what sriracha tastes like. So, you know, we call it living between Asian American, like we're right there in the middle. And if you go too far one direction, then you get lost or you lose the consumer, right? But that's kind of like our competitive advantage is we live between these two worlds, Asian America, and we know how to balance it and we can kind of go between them. And we know like, hey, if you go too far in one direction, you're going to lose somebody.
You live on the hyphen between Asian and American.
Yeah, we live right there. Yeah.
When it comes to your innovation strategy, who are the key players in your company? Because I'm sure there's so many different voices that are out there and so many ways you can go. You know, ultimately, who determines the direction of your product strategy?
Yeah, so I spend a lot of my time on innovation, and I work with a number of consultants, food scientists, manufacturers, and I also work with people internally who help me with ingredient procurement. I still spend most of my time, I would say, on innovation. I do think that it's important to have an innovation lead, and you know, you can have a group of people that are helping vet the ideas, but I do think it's important for one person to have the vision of where the, you know, the innovation pipeline for like the next 5 or 10 years, because you know, if you do have a group that just says, okay, we're going to do this together, what you're going to end up with is a committee, and you're going to end up with, you know, the average of everybody's input. And, you know, the average really never delights people in the way that somebody with a strong vision can. So an example of this, you know, Mondelez launched a snack product called Veya, and they wanted to be, you know, a world-inspired product. And then, you know, they were launching it in different markets around the world, from the US to China to India. I think it lasted less than 2 years, and they just were just trying to please way too many people, right? A big company like Mondelez needs it to be a big success, but it ended up kind of getting lost down there. So I would say that, you know, it's important to have really, really, really strong belief. And I think you should get excited by your own innovation. Like, if you're not super excited about it, you got to ask yourself, does it still deserve to exist? Because you're going to be the one selling it in. And if you're not super excited about it, how are you going to sell it in to people? I don't know. I try to look at innovation as a huge opportunity for most companies. It's always been one of our biggest growth drivers here at Dang. And it's something that I really enjoy doing.
How far in advance do you plan out your innovation pipeline? As in, are you thinking about launching new products at Expo West 2021, 2022?
Yes, we already have products that we're working on in the pipeline for the next couple of years. And then we've already mapped out which direction. Do we want to stay in the same category? Do we want to branch out into different categories? We've already mapped that out over the next, I'd say, 5 years.
Do you feel like that's typical of the industry, or is that something that's sort of unique to your situation, to your brand?
I don't know. You know, I think you can ask other brands that, but I think it's important to have a vision and a product pipeline. You know, I think it's important to be able to show that to potential investors, potential acquirers, and say, hey, you know, this is what you can do if you take this business and this brand. These are the different areas you can take it in and kind of have it all set up. And if you have that already prepared, like if you actually have prototypes, if you actually have manufacturers set up and have figured out all the details, like the pricing and the food stability, it's like, hey, you're solving more problems for other folks down the road.
It's helpful to have good advisors to map out that plan, that roadmap. And you guys have a pretty powerful partner in Sonoma Brands, which is led by John Sebastiani, the founder of Crave Jerky, of Smash Mallow, and other brands as well. When did that partnership come to being?
Yeah, so Sonoma Brands called us back in, I think we picked our deal in 2016. We probably started talking in late 2015, which was, I think, around the same time, like right after they sold Crave Jerky. And, you know, John called us and told us what he was doing with as far as trying to keep his team together, raising a fund. So we were part of the first Sonoma Brands fund. Yeah, we kind of hit it off right from the start. You know, we love how hungry he is. You know, he's really, really strategic and is always, you know, aware of what's going on in the marketplace. And I would say by marketplace, I mean M&A marketplace within the industry. So he's very aware of the appetite and what big brands are looking for in small brands and what trends are going, are people banking on now. So I would say he brought a lot of data and strategic value today as one of our board members.
Is it hard to stick to your guns when you're talking to someone like John? Because he's been there, done that, and continues to do it so well. Let's say you are steadfast in your belief about one particular part of your strategy, and he's like, look, this is not the way to go. I mean, how does that conversation play out?
Yeah, I think not him in particular, but I think, you know, when you have a board of directors, typically board members are older, experienced, and bring a lot of, you know, knowledge to the game. But I do think that, you know, as a founder and entrepreneur, you have to really stick to what you believe in, right? And so I'll be honest, there was some controversy over whether or not we should launch a bar. Right. And so they were like, hey, the bar is a new category. It's super competitive. You know, you have your coconut chips and your rice chips. Like, that's already a lot to deal with. But I knew that there was a consumer need that I wasn't being met. And I knew that we could fill this need. And, you know, luckily, I knew that I stuck to my guns and I was like, hey, listen, we need to do this. And, you know, last year we grew 54%. A lot of it was from the bar, became the number one bar at Whole Foods last year. I'm very happy that I stuck to my guns and I'm very, it taught me a big lesson in leadership and standing up for what you believe in.
So sticking to your guns when it came to the snack bar, it seems taught you quite a bit about confidence and confidence in your leadership. How else has your leadership evolved over the past 8 years?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, this is the first company I started. I would say my brother was the first employee, and he brings a huge value to the table. Like, you know, we're very different. He's very, he has a CPA background. So he's really good with running the day-to-day, really good with finances, you know, runs our team. Really, we have run our very tight ship, and we've always been very lean, I would say, you know, probably more so than most companies. We've always really been focused on costs. And part of that's probably Asian upbringing and always being aware of like, hey, you know, we don't want to waste money. So I would say leadership style, though, you know, there's a few things that I've learned along the way that really help out. So one way that we guide the culture here at Dang is through core values, right? So we work with a coach to help us identify those things that we do that are very different from other companies. And part of that was interviews with our employees. We asked them, hey, how is Dang different than other places you've worked? And then part of that is just internal soul searching of like, hey, us as a company, you know, and the founders, what are you doing that's different than other folks? And so we have five core values. First one's work smart, which is basically, hey, we want to work smart, not necessarily hard. We want to use data to make the right decisions so we don't, you know, we're not scrambling around trying to like push everything uphill. So that's one thing. You know, clarity is very important. So everyone should know their roles, what's expected of them, who to go to for information. It's nice to know what's expected of you when you come to work every day. We have safety, and that's specifically psychological safety. So we think that people can only, you know, fulfill their potential if they feel psychologically safe and feel like they're not going to be punished if they fail. We have play. So we think that it's important to keep things light. And we have like daily lunches here in the office with everybody gets together, and we don't talk about work. And, you know, that's generally a very light, nice conversation that we have with the whole team and everyone, for me to, you know, our interns all eat together. And the last one's modesty. We want to make sure we don't get too full of ourselves. And I like to use the term where we like to be cautiously optimistic. So we always, you know, plan for success and then prepare for the worst if that doesn't happen.
Now, Vincent, you and your brother are the co-founders of Dang Foods. And, you know, as this industry that we participate has evolved over the past decade, we've seen more minority leaders, minority entrepreneurs entering the business, more female entrepreneurs entering the business. There's still a question of whether or not the natural foods industry is as inclusive as it could be. Do you see it that way? And what are some of the ways that we can improve that perception?
Yeah, it's really a great big issue. And, you know, when I started, there weren't a lot of people at Expo West that looked like me. And I'm glad now that there are. I'm also glad, like, you know, I think our new positioning as Asian American, you know, being an Asian American snack brand, I think will hopefully inspire others to see, oh, you know, there's a company doing this and they've never seen that before. It's only been, you know, restaurants that have really like make me feel seen. So I'm hoping it'll inspire another, you know, cohort of folks that can say, hey, we can lead with heritage and be proud of who we are and just put it on package as well. So, you know, at Expo West, we were planning on launching the JEDEC Collaborative, which is a group that I'm a part of. It's an industry group focused on justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. I'm on their working group. And really, there's a couple of big focuses that we have. First, we want to measure the amount of underrepresented minorities. We're under measure the amount of LGBTQ women and disabled on leadership and board levels across the industry. So that's the first thing is like an industry survey, which we've already done. And then we want to get commitments from companies to, you know, up those numbers. And then we want to revisit that in 5 years in 2025 and see how far we've come as an industry. So it's very simple. Measure what you're doing, set a goal, and then measure if you made progress. And so I'm proud to be part of that. I'm also part of Asian American groups like Gold House, which are supporting not just Asian American films, but, you know, let's say culture from underrepresented minorities across media. And that's been a really fun for me to be part of as well.
So was the JEDEC Initiative formed mostly to focus on issues of representation and the lack of representation of certain groups, certain ethnic and minority groups in this country? Or did it have something to do with potential and unfortunately prevalent biases regarding certain minority groups, potentially like Asian Americans?
For me, there's a couple of things. First, you know, having an industry that represents the actual makeup of the U.S. will actually help from a business perspective, too. So, like, how could you meet the needs of all the different groups and cohorts? I mean, America is a super diverse place, right? And how can you meet the needs of all those folks if the industry doesn't look like that? So I think it's actually going to help grow the industry in the longer term by being inclusive and bringing in people of different backgrounds. So that's number one. Secondly, you know, as far as your question of stereotypes, and I do think people have come a long way, but I do think there's still a lot of misperceptions of, like, particularly when it comes with power and who's running companies. So I'll sometimes be standing next to a booth and I'll be talking with some folks and some people will come up to my VP of sales. He's like tall, 6'3", you know, kind of big white dude from Texas, and start talking to him as if he's the founder. And he's great. And he always, you know, kind of brings him over to me. But there's I think unconscious bias is a big thing that we have to grapple with, right? And it may take a huge, has a huge impact on hiring. So, you know, one thing that the JEDEC group is doing unconscious bias trainings. And so anyone who's responsible for hiring or, you know, basically responsible for interacting with people can understand, oh, okay, these are some biases that I have. And then at least, you know, being aware of it is the first step to actually balancing it out.
Vincent, this has been such a great conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time. Even though we didn't get to meet up in person at Expo West, I have a feeling we'll have that chance at a future trade show or conference. And I look forward to it because Dang is a pretty impressive brand and it's been fun to follow its evolution.
Thanks for having me.
That brings us to the end of episode 204. Thank you so much for listening and thanks to our guest, Vincent Kittiratragarn. You can catch both Taste Radio and Taste Radio Insider on tasteradio.com, the Apple Podcasts app, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. As always, for questions, comments, ideas for future podcasts, please send us an email to ask@tasteradio.com. On behalf of the entire Taste Radio team, thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.